On this week's edition of New York Now, lawmakers digest Governor Andrew Cuomo's state budget proposal. Not everyone's happy.
On fossil fuels, public power now!
Republican Minority Leader John Flanagan joins us with his take on the budget and New York's recent changes to cash bail.
But raising taxes would be awful for our economy.
And we'll have analysis of Cuomo's environmental goals this year, plus the Reporters Roundtable is in. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.
Today, the Senate majority will pass legislation
law prohibiting it, and we will take them to court challenging it.
Get another stand for New York and sending a message to the nation.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. So nobody's happier it's the weekend than members of the state legislature. They sat through more than 50 hours of testimony this week about Governor Andrew Cuomo's state budget proposal. It's a routine process for Albany. Lawmakers will hold hearings over the next several weeks on the proposed spending plan. Then they'll duke it out with Cuomo in March until they agree on a final state budget. Everything seemed to be going smoothly during the first hearing on this week's state budget. It was about Cuomo's plans for the environment. Then this happened.
On fossil fuels, public power now. On fossil fuels, public power now.
So, not everyone's happy with Cuomo's budget. We'll dive deeper into concerns over his policies on the environment later with one of the state's leading advocates. But first, Republicans in the state legislature have their own issues with Cuomo's budget and the way Democrats are handling key issues like bail reform. Senate Minority Leader John Flanagan sat down with our Karen DeWitt to talk about that and more.
Senator Flanagan, thanks for joining us again in New York Now. It's been a little while.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So since you were last on, we had the 2018 elections. You lost a number of seats. There's now 23 Republicans to 40 Democrats. And your position's kind of changed, wondering what your strategy is, how you do things different now that you're a member of what they used to call the loyal opposition.
Well, the old days are the new days today as well. You know, we play a very critical role. We represent about 7 million people, I think, but we represent the entire state as well. So I think you've heard me say this. I have the luxury and the privilege, and I'm unabashed in saying I'm now in my 34th year in the legislature, proud of the work that I do. More than half of my time has been spent in the minority. If I wallowed in the notion that I'm in the majority versus the minority, I never would have gotten anything done. And I think my work in the minority helped get me to the position that I was ultimately in.
So what is the difference? Obviously, you're not going to be one of the people in the leaders' meetings, the so-called three men in a room now, two men and a woman. So you don't have the influence and power. I mean, what do you do to get your ideas across?
I respectfully have to disagree. I have influence, I have power, and the one great thing that I have with every other member in both houses, I have my vote. And I will use my vote accordingly. So I completely believe that I and every one of my colleagues has influence and power. So what I'm going to do and what I've done all along, I will be diplomatic, I will be aggressive, I will be assertive, I will be professional, and I'm going to hit. I'm going to hit hard on things that I believe in. I'm going to hit equally, if not more, harder, on things that I don't believe in. When I say I'm speaking as an individual member, but as the leader of the Republican Conference.
So last year, the Democrats passed a number of major issues. I felt like as reporters, we kind of watched them all roll by. Certainly, it was Republicans weren't saying a lot, but now there have been some consequences for their actions. And in some cases, I know that you believe that they might have gone a little bit too far. And one issue that you've been talking about is the bail reform changes. Can you talk about what you're uneasy about that?
I'm uneasy, I'm frustrated, I'm angry, I'm disappointed. There's a whole array of emotions and none of them are positive. And this is the number one issue. It is not even close. There's nothing second. Taxes, everything else, education spending, the budget. This is what people are talking about. I was on the phone with a friend of mine the other day. I haven't spoken to him in months. This is what he's bringing up. It is bad public policy. It's bad governmental policy. Politically, I find it amazing that the Democrats are still embracing what was really poor implementation.
Well, we should explain it. As of January 1st, most forms of cash bail have ended for nonviolent crimes, right?
So yes, but that's a real misnomer in my opinion. The notion that It's nonviolent. There are plenty of violent crimes that involve rape, assault, vehicular assault, that now have no bail attached to them. So I'm not giving anyone a pass. I'm certainly not giving the Democrats on a pass saying that this is for low-level crimes and nonviolent felonies. I don't consider possession of child pornography or a sexual act involving a child to be something that is ministerial or nonviolent.
So what are some examples of those things that you're talking about where you think people have might have gone free when they really shouldn't have?
I have papers with me. I have a sheet with 6 pages of over 50 examples of glaring failures with the new law. And everyone said this is fear-mongering. This is real life. This is applications that have been attested to by district attorneys, by law enforcement, by real people, by victims. God forbid we should talk about the victims. And a lot of the not-for-profit groups, including domestic violent groups, that are saying this is a very ill-conceived, bad law that is only getting worse by the day. So there are, unfortunately, there are multiple glaring examples.
So isn't it really likely that the bail reform changes are going to be repealed? The Assembly Democrats don't want to do it, but we've heard some Democrats, even Governor Andrew Cuomo, saying that maybe it should be tweaked. So you think there's chances that there could be changes made this year?
You know,
is that possible to happen?
It's astounding when people want swiftness and, you know, surety of action. The governor could do this. The governor could do this and say, I want a moratorium. There should be a moratorium or a repeal. I believe there should be a repeal. I think we should start over with an earnest effort towards real reform, making no distinctions between rich and poor. The Assembly Democrats are doing so at their own peril. I want to repeat, the Democrats, the Assembly Democrats, the Senate Democrats, and the governor. I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. They own it. They own it. And now it's fascinating to watch my Democratic colleagues walk this back. They're all, one of my colleagues from Long Island, she said that this was snuck in the budget. There was a very intensive, lengthy debate between Senator Gennaris and Senator Lanza. Senator Lanza is one of the brightest minds in the legislature, is a former DA, and every single thing that he talked about, every single Democrat was aware of. Senator Todd Kominsky has said that the law needs to be changed. He's one of the primary authors of this legislation. He's a former prosecutor. You can't have it both ways. So moratorium or repeal and make positive changes that actually help everybody.
Yeah, it does appear some Democrats, including Governor Cuomo, having some second thoughts on this. But I want to move on to the budget. There's a $6 billion deficit this year. The governor has proposed a kind of commission, a Medicaid redesign team, to cut $2.5 billion out of Medicaid as a way of plugging the gap. Do you think that that's a good way to do it? And what's your general reaction on how to deal with the deficit?
Well, I'm gratified to see that there are not huge increases in taxes, at least in the governor's proposal, but the Senate and Assembly Democrats are blithely going along with their normal platform and saying we need to increase taxes and raise revenue. That's the worst thing we could do for jobs and economic development, particularly in our upstate region. With regard to the deficit, this is a measure of their overspending. This is the exact same thing that happened in 2009 and 2010, the last time the Democrats were in complete control. Profligate spending, more taxes, revenues, and fees without a commensurate benefit to actual taxpayers. With regard to the Medicaid redesign team, I want to be consistent. I don't have any problem bringing in the pros and the people who are going to be affected by this. That didn't happen on bail reform. If you're bringing in the hospitals and nursing homes and long-term care and all the people affected, including counties and everyone else, it should be ugly because it's going to be uncomfortable.
That's true, because you were in the majority then, so you were part of that even the first
Absolutely.
Time they did the Medicaid redesign,
yes.
early in Cuomo's term. Yeah.
And I don't find anything wrong with that. But the one thing that the legislature should not do, because this is by design, do not cede your authority. Ultimately, this should come back to the legislature. A Medicaid redesign team, yes. But ultimately, you want me and my colleagues to be individually and collectively accountable to the taxpayers. No one should be able to say, well, this group did it or this commission did it. The Democrats have done that on a whole variety of things, including a new commuter tax, on climate change. They kicked the can down the road. Having a team is one thing. Owning it and saying I had to vote in favor up or down, I think that's more important because the voters want to be able to look at me or anyone else and say, okay, this is what you did or what you didn't do. These are going to be difficult choices. There's no reason it can't be done on time and can't be done properly. But raising taxes would be awful for our economy. And we're not even talking about it. The governor in his budget in the State of the State talked about left out and said there were things that are going great in the upstate economy. We have the worst out-migration of any state in the country, and it's far more acute in areas outside the city of New York. So there's a, in spite of the Medicaid redesign team and a $6 billion deficit, there's a lot of things they're just not talking about factually.
2020's an election year. Any bright spots for Senate Republicans? I should mention you're losing a lot of longtime members who aren't going to run again. Betty Little, Joe Roebuck, Ken LaValle, just to name a few. What's your strategy for getting any seats back?
Yeah, well, first of all, we have to have a proactive, clear agenda that people can embrace. What do we stand for? What's our philosophy? What are our principles? Go back to our core values. And I think if we don't articulate that properly, then shame on us. I believe we're doing that, and we're juxtaposing ourselves against the Democrats who are, the bail reform is a perfect example, raising taxes last year. So we also have an obligation to recruit good candidates, really quality candidates, and we're doing that.
It's going to be an exciting year. We're looking forward to it. Thanks for coming on with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, and now for analysis of the week's news, we're at the Reporters Roundtable, where I'm happy to be joined by a first-time guest, Marina Villeneuve, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Associated Press, and of course, Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio. Thanks very much for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Karen, we just heard your interview with John Flanagan. One thing to add to it, the GOP is going to go around the state and stage roundtables on the contentious issue of criminal justice reform.
That's right. The Republicans have really kind of seized on this issue. They feel like it's a weak point for Democrats. And most notably, these roundtables are in Buffalo, Long Island, and Syracuse. Not Albany, not New York City, but places where they hope to either retain some of their remaining seats or pick up seats. So they really are pressing on this, and I don't think we're going to hear the end of it. We even heard one of the Senate Democrats from Long Island, newly elected Monica Martinez, saying that she feels like she's not going to vote for the state budget unless it includes some kind of bail reform to bail reform.
Rollback of
a rollback to it, and you know, maybe letting judges having some more discretion about who they can retain pretrial.
Well, we are in budget season, and we got the first kind of really big contentious a joint legislative budget hearing. This one, of course, on the contentious issue of the Medicaid budget. The lawmakers, especially the Democrats, were just leaning into Howard Zucker, Donna Frescatore, top Cuomo administration healthcare officials on how exactly the cuts were going to happen and the makeup of the Medicaid redesign team.
Mm-hmm. We definitely heard a lot of really pointed questions from senators, including Senator Gustavo Rivera, who was, you know, I think there's a real sense that the administration hasn't been necessarily very forthcoming with sort of its, you know, plans for how this is all going to turn out. We're still waiting on an announcement about who exactly is going to be on this new Medicaid redesign team.
Right. That's remarkable. It's because they've only got 2 months to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like Cuomo's just trying to cut the legislature out of the biggest part of the budget, because the biggest thing they have to do is restructure Medicaid and cut $2.5 billion. And who's going to get hurt? Providers, patients. Cuomo says they won't. Are local governments going to have to pay more through this kind of complicated scheme that the governor has worked up? And if this commission doesn't report back until, say, March 20th, March 28th, the legislature is going to have no choice but to go along with what the governor wants. And you really could see the tensions. They feel really angry about it. I mean, this is a Democratic governor, Democratic state legislature, but they're just, they just seem to be wearing on each other at this point.
When the lawmakers were, or when the top Cuomo administration officials were asked, how are local governments meant to, oversee these cuts, it seemed like the answers were insufficient.
Yes, I think that there is, you know, a big question about how exactly this is going to impact counties. The Association of Counties in New York, they estimate that outside of New York City, that counties could be facing up to, you know, $200 million in costs because of Cuomo's proposed reforms. And New York City said it could face $1.1 billion in tax revenue. And I think that there's a sense that, you know, the economy is doing so strong in New York that there's just sort of this question about why, we're talking about such big cuts and if there is a potential that maybe we're going to see increased tax revenue or if there's other savings that could sort of solve this.
Right.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, Commissioner Zucker and the Medicaid Director Frescatore, they just kind of took it. They didn't engage. They didn't really give them any answers. And I think Governor Cuomo kind of over the years has picked commissioners who are really good at this. They're not going to get in a big public fight. and get headlines. They're just kind of like, well, yes, okay, we'll get you those that paperwork later, or we'll ask someone if you're allowed to have that paperwork, which just added to the lawmakers' frustration, really.
Moving in parallel to this is the ongoing debate about something, Medicaid cuts has to go into the budget. One thing that the governor would like to see in the budget is the legalization of recreational use marijuana. Crystal People Stokes, Assemblywoman from Western New York, is pushing that for revenue from sales of rec-use marijuana needs to go, or at least a significant portion of it, to help communities that were affected by the war on drugs. The governor, however, in his initial budget plan, wants to see that revenue go into the general fund. Is there a middle ground here?
You know, I think the governor, his proposal, he would like to have this sort of the revenue go toward a bunch of different things, and his administration have a lot of say over what it could go to. And it seems like, you know, there is a concern that the state should be saying that a specific amount should go to this, specific amount to that. That was an issue that held it up. Legalization last year, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of movement on a very key issue.
I know, Crystal People Stokes says that's a deal breaker. It has to go to the communities. But once again, it's kind of about control. The governor wants to be able to give the money to the communities and not lose control of that funding stream. That is going to be a big fight in the budget, I think, and that's probably going to come down to the wire. And I think, don't you, that if it's not in the budget, it's probably not going to happen.
Definitely.
Another issue that reached some kind of resolution this week, a judge knocked down the Commission on Prosecutorial Misconduct, which was created by legislation last year. The judge basically said that the legislation included a new role for the appellate division that needs to be assigned through a constitutional change. It could not just be done legislatively. Is this something that lawmakers might try and fix this year, along with, of course, all the controversy over criminal justice reform?
Well, I think that DAs want their independence, and they don't want somebody looking over them, and they are independently elected. That was the argument, I guess, that the judge made, that if they're independently elected, you can't have this body looking over them. So it's a question, is the legislature going to go back and try to fix this? Are they going to give up on this? I mean, that's another issue that's just out there.
It's definitely the latest sort of litigation we've been seeing against different state commissions that lawmakers have set up that have been sort of facing these concerns about separation of powers. And
yeah, that's a good point. Pay raise commission.
Right, pay raise
part of that
commission.
Got struck down in court. That's
the,
right.
The creation of, you know, taxpayer funded campaigns commission.
That's right. Yeah.
And now, is there a chance, of course, that the Medicaid redesign team, which, as we noted, only has 8 weeks to work, that if they are given sort of too much leeway to make changes, that those could be subject to legal challenges as well?
I actually hadn't thought of that, but you're right. That could end up leading to some kind of court battle and having something rescinded, which would be a big mess for the state spending plan.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is where we're going to have to leave it. So thanks very much to Marina Villeneuve of the Associated Press. Thanks for coming in. Please
Thank
come
you.
Back. And, of course, Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio.
Thanks to Casey and this week's roundtable. So earlier tonight, we told you that not everyone's happy with Governor Andrew Cuomo's plans for the environment this year. Advocates agree that Cuomo's headed in the right direction, but they want more from New York, protecting the state's water and natural resources. One of those advocates is Liz Moran. She's the Environmental Policy Director at the New York Public Interest Research Group. She sat down with me after this week's hearing. Liz Moran from NYPIRG, thank you so much for joining us this week on New York Now.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Anytime. So the governor wants to spend, from what I can tell, $33 billion over the next 5 years to what he calls combat climate change. What are we talking about here? What is this money going to be spent on from his perspective?
Yeah, so it's a package of programs, some of which we already know about and have actually been announced already and are in the works. The new program in that $33 billion is a proposed $3 billion Environmental Bond Act that the governor has dubbed the Restore Mother Nature Bond Act. And that would fund a variety of initiatives to protect land and water, to use our natural resources, to protect us from the impacts of climate change. But we're going to need some key details here. We need to have better understanding of what programs exactly will be funded by this Bond Act, and critically, who's going to pay? Is it going to be the taxpayers, or will it be the oil and gas industry?
Do we have any indication on what the governor wants to spend the $3 billion on? It seems like a lot of money just to say, give it to me and I'm going to do what I please with it.
So the governor has listed out in the budget proposal the different types of things that the Bond Act could fund, but we are looking for more specifics in terms of what kinds of programs. And thankfully, we do have a good example that already exists. The last big Environmental Bond Act that was passed in 1986 shows a great way as to how we can break down this spending and how it could be written.
So we've done this before. I didn't realize that. What happened back then? What did we do with the money then, I guess?
Yeah, so it was approximately a $1.5 billion bond act, and it was wildly supported by the public. That's the great thing about initiatives like these. People understand we absolutely need to be investing to make sure we have clean water, clean air, and that our environment is safe for the public. So these tend to have good popular support, and we expect this one would as well, but we have to make sure that it's transparent, that we get it right, and we think it's really important that the fossil fuel industry pays for this.
So that's really interesting. So the Bond Act, from what I understand, it would go to voters for approval. It wouldn't be done exclusively by the legislature. Is $3 billion enough for something like this, or would you like to see more?
Yeah, that's a great question. Environmental needs are tremendous, and we do think it should be more than $3 billion. We think at a minimum it should be $5 billion, but it could be even more than that. So for example, water infrastructure needs in New York State are tremendous. It's been estimated over the next 20 years we're going to need to invest $80 billion in both drinking water and wastewater infrastructure.
And why? What do we need?
Well, it's very outdated. We've gone such a long period of time without properly investing in this infrastructure that it's now starting to fail. The demands on this infrastructure are far greater than they used to be. Populations in a number of cities have grown. Climate change is leading to more freeze and thaw cycles, causing strain on the infrastructure. So it's breaking. So now we have a lot of catching up to do. We've made progress, but we need to keep investing in it. And that's just water infrastructure. So you add in all the investments we need to make to fight toxic chemicals like PFOA and PFOS, all the investments we need to do to make sure we are investing in renewable energy and fighting climate change. The price tag for protecting our environment and our future as a result is going to cost a lot. We need to make sure that we are keeping up.
So you are one of the leading environmental advocates in the state, and you presumably have a good relationship with lawmakers. What do they think about the governor's Bond Act? Do they seem positive towards it? Do they want more money? Have we heard anything?
So far, it's been met with a lot of excitement. I think that regardless of where you look in New York State, regardless of the district, there are environmental needs in every district. So I think, like advocates, lawmakers want more details. I've certainly heard there's interest in more funding. And I think they want to get it right. And so do we. So I think we'll have a great ally in the legislature.
So before we run out of time, I just want to talk to you about something else that happened this week. There was this hearing on the state's ban on plastic bags, which is set to take effect March 1st. And this law was passed last year. So I guess the big question from my perspective is, why did we have this hearing now? What was it about, and what did we see there?
Yeah, so last year we had a tremendous year for the environment, and we passed a law that will ban single-use plastic bags in New York. Now, that law is set to take effect March 1st, so just a month away, and the Department of Environmental Conservation proposed some regulations to complement the law. But unfortunately, that's led to even more confusion. For example, there's a provision that would allow for a thicker type of plastic bag. This might sound a little confusing, right?
Yeah, people, why would we want to allow that if we're going to ban plastic bags? It seems like that would use more of the material that would be used to make plastic bags.
That's exactly right. That's exactly our concern. So plastic, people understand as a big pollution issue. We know we see on beaches and along the highways plastic bags and other single-use plastics. But the production of plastic is also a contributing factor to climate change. It takes fossil fuels to produce plastic. So we really need to start making sure that our production of plastic dramatically decreases if we're to fight climate change. So these thicker plastic bags, one, we know that consumers are unlikely to use them any differently, even if they are dubbed reusable. And two, we really shouldn't be producing them because we have to stop producing the amount of plastic we are as it is.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. We'll take a look out for that. Liz Moran from NYPIRG, thank you so much for joining us on New York Now.
Thanks again for having me.
To learn more about what we covered on tonight's show, head over to New York Now's website at nynow.org and follow us on social media at nynow_PBS. Until then, I'm Dan Clark. Thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.